You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, August is National Make-A-Will Month. So before we turn the calendar to September, we'll talk about how to make a will and why we need them. Plus, we'll get into probate and other estate planning matters. Now, we're talking about fish elevators. You heard that right. Sturgeon are a unique fish in Lake Michigan. They're the size of human beings, and they can live for 150 years. Their numbers have dropped over the years, though, due in part to dams being in the way of their historic spawning patterns on the Menominee River. But thanks to the Fish Passage Project, a partnership between the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Wisconsin DNR, the EPA, power companies, and others, sturgeon are able to get a lift, literally, upstream to lay their eggs. In the process, researchers are using their DNA to track their success and population numbers. We've got two guests here. Rob Elliott is a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service based in Green Bay. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Keely. Thank you.
And Patrick Forsyth is an associate professor of biology at UW Green Bay, focusing on aquatic ecosystems and fish populations in the Great Lakes. Patrick, good to have you with us.
Hi, Keely. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Patrick, let's start out with some context. Give us a sense of what's happened with the sturgeon population over the past few centuries.
Well, it's a really good question. Most reports will indicate that lake sturgeon have declined substantially across the Great Lakes. And right now they're at perhaps around 1% of their historic abundance. And so, historically, we used to have a lot of fish swimming around out there. But, because of pressures like overharvest and pollution to our rivers and what we're going to talk about today, which is, hydroelectric facilities and dams on rivers, their abundance has really declined over the past couple of centuries.
And this is a fish that has cultural importance, especially for Wisconsin's Native American tribes?
Yeah, of course. It's sort of interesting. I think a lot of people sort of know that sturgeon had a very historical significance to Native American populations for subsistence. I've heard reports of Native American tribes actually tracking sturgeon migrations. But what's really interesting to me is that these same Native American populations also used to really hold the sites where sturgeon spawned as very historic and significant cultural locations as well. And they would also view the size of the spawning run and the success of their harvest as being sort of a telltale sign of things to come. And so when sturgeon numbers started to decline, there was an obvious connection between, things that were potentially not, going right for the sturgeon populations, but also potentially for what was happening upstream.
So, Rob, I have to say, I'm not sure I've thought of fish and elevators in the same sentence before now, but we've built them to make sure that sturgeon get to spawn, I guess, sort of normally. Tell us about this process.
Right. Well, elevators have been used for a long time to move fish above barriers, and in this case, dams. So it's not that new of a technology, but it is new for the use for sturgeon in the Great Lakes. So this is really the first elevator that's been built specifically for sturgeon in the Great Lakes. And there's a number of things that need to come together in order to make a river or a location ideal for building an elevator. And one is what you want to have enough sturgeon that are coming back that are being blocked at a dam. And the Menominee River just happens to be one of those cases where it made a lot of sense. Sturgeon exists still in naturally in about 8 rivers around Lake Michigan. But as Patrick mentioned, these populations are quite low compared to their historic abundance. But when the dams were built on the Menominee River, there were a number of sturgeon that were probably living in the river upstream, and sturgeon historically were able to move up the Menominee River about 80 miles to Sturgeon Falls. So that was their historic furthest upstream extent. And when the dams got built, a number of sturgeon remained in the river above the dams or in between the dams. And so those sections between the dams, if they were long enough, 30 miles or so, that was enough for the sturgeon populations to persist. But over time, a few sturgeon every year would move downstream, and that was sort of a one-way direction. So over time, sturgeon started to accumulate in the furthest downriver section of the Menominee, which had access to Green Bay. But when it came time for the sturgeon to spawn, they were only able to move upstream a few miles. The first dams were built 2.5 miles upriver from the mouth, and they were not able to get above the dams back up to maybe where they were born or where they originated. So this was a river that had a large accumulation of sturgeon below the first dam, but there was still good habitat upriver for the sturgeon to progress. A lot of the other rivers around Lake Michigan, the first dams are quite a bit further upriver, 20 to 50 miles, and so there is still plenty of habitat for those populations to slowly recover on their own, which I should add, they have been doing gradually over the last century. You know, the sturgeon populations were really wiped out in the late 1800s. And just because of their life history, long-lived, slow-growing, late maturing, it only took about 20 years for human settlers to pretty much wipe the populations out. So they went from millions down to just thousands. And
Rob Elliott is a
time, they've been able to hang on for a long time.
Right. So now we're trying to undo a little bit of the damage. Rob Elliott is a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service based in Green Bay. Also talking with Patrick Forsyth, who's an associate professor at UW Green Bay, focuses on ecosystems and fish in the Great Lakes. And Rob, we mentioned that sturgeon are pretty massive. Is it difficult to handle them when they come through the fish elevator?
Well, the whole process keeps them in the water the whole time. So when they come into the elevator, it lifts them and the water up about 20 feet and then spills the water into a holding tank. So the fish are always in water. If you try to grab them when they're in the water, they're not tired. So, yeah, they can be a handful, but the whole process intends to keep them in the water the whole time. So they go from the fish elevator into a holding tank, from the holding tank into a transport trailer, all the time staying in the water. The transport trailer then takes them upstream an additional mile, and that's only because there's two dams that are very close together, and it was easier to pass them around both dams at once rather than having to build two fish elevators.
Sure. Patrick, you're also gathering DNA from the sturgeon as they pass through. How are you using that to track the fish and whether it's spawning?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the questions that the overall project had was, you know, once the sturgeon are moved upstream, will they stay upstream? And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they will. And then the follow-up question is, will they go all the way up, you know, to where they're intended to go, back to their roughly their historic spawning locations and reproduce successfully? And so to answer that question, we're able to use genetic techniques to be able to tie a parent to an offspring, to a larvae that we collect in the spring at the time that spawning happens. And so, you know, 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, the genetic technology wasn't really there to be able to do this. But now we have the ability to tie the parents to the likely offspring that they've produced. And so it's been a huge advancement to the project and to the question. But it starts with the elevator. And so, you know, we keep moving fish. We have the opportunity to try to tie those parents to successful reproductive events, which is really neat.
And sturgeon don't spawn every year, but so far, Patrick, are you seeing encouraging signs?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of encouraging signs, I would say, related to my portion of the project. Number one, this past spring, we were able to successfully catch enough larvae to run the project, or, you know, to be able to tie the parents to the larvae. And, you know, in addition to that, we were able to document that some of the fish were likely up there spawning with some other radio and acoustic telemetry techniques. So once we get through this spring or this winter and we're able to run the genetic analysis, we feel pretty confident that we should be able to find a few larvae that were produced by the fish that were passed with the project, with the elevator.
Yeah, this project has a lot of different groups and agencies involved. Rob, how did everyone feel about helping the sturgeon spawn? Does everybody realize its importance?
Yes, this has actually been a very long effort. Hydropower dams go through relicensing periods, and it was on the schedule about 15 years ago on everybody's radar that an opportunity to implement fish passage at this dam was coming up. And so the two state agencies that are involved, Michigan DNR and Wisconsin DNR, a couple of NGOs, River Alliance of Wisconsin and Michigan Hydro Relicensing Coalition, were involved, as well as the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then key is a willing hydro owner, and in this case, Eagle Creek Renewable Energies. And they could see the strong benefit of passing sturgeon at these two facilities. And so they knew it would be best for them to be on board early on, which allowed us to also seek outside funding. So it didn't all have to come from the hydropower company. You mentioned EPA's involvement. They've been instrumental in providing funding through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. There's been a number of grant sources. The Great Lakes Restoration Fund was also instrumental in helping provide funds for this. So there have been a number of partners. And I should also mention the research projects have brought in additional partners. So Patrick's at UW-Green Bay. UW-Stevens Point's also been involved in two previous research projects. So we're kind of working through a step of a number of important research questions. We're now on project number three, and there's a fourth one further down the road, assuming everything continues to go well.
Excellent. More to talk about. Rob, thank you for your time.
Sure.
And Patrick, thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Rob Elliott and Patrick Forsyth talked with us about the Fish Passage Project on the Menominee River. It gives sturgeons a lift in an elevator, a checkup from researchers, and a ride down a water slide to help them reach their spawning grounds upstream. Coming up, we talk about an organization in one Wisconsin community that's aiming to make virtual school more effective for students while taking some of the pressure off parents. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. As some students in Wisconsin head back to virtual school, parents are trying to balance their own jobs with their kids' education. We'll look at how one group in the state aims to make the situation better for children and their moms and dads. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look at how Wisconsin became the Badger State.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, why is the badger Wisconsin's state animal? WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the badger state. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah, lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon, and they were called, you know, sometimes called badger holes. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes, and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead. And actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia. And most of those species are much more social. But our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances. So a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now it's back to school time in Wisconsin, though not in the physical sense for all students. More rural schools are bringing kids back into buildings, and most larger districts are starting online. The COVID-19 pandemic has many schools across the state opening at least partially virtually. And that can be tough for parents who have to juggle their responsibilities to their kids while also working. And it could be hard on kids who aren't able to interact with their friends and teachers. So some parents around the country are forming so-called pandemic pods. They're small groups of students paired with a teacher who meet someplace like in a home. In Eau Claire, Pablo Center at the Confluence is starting up learning pods to help families in the Chippewa Valley with virtual and hybrid learning. Jason John Anderson is the executive director of Pablo Center. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, how are the learning pods you're creating going to work?
Yeah, so the learning pods that we've created here at Pablo Center, they house 15 students apiece across four separate classrooms. So we have the ability to have 60 students Monday and Tuesday, or Thursday and Friday, which aligns with the Eau Claire School District, Altoona School District, and Chippewa School District. So the primary schools that we have, it aligns with their virtual learning days. We have classroom facilitators, classroom assistants, workshop facilitators in each of those classrooms. We have DPI certified past instructors who've come back. And the overall sort of structure, much as you've laid out, is to really offset that challenge to families that are trying to figure out how can mom and dad get into the workplace. And so we have arrivals from 7:30 to 8 a.m. and then pickup from 5 to 5:30 p.m. and additional partnerships with the Boys and Girls Club here in Eau Claire for students 5th through 8th grade, even though this program is structured for 5th through 12th graders.
You know, the idea that schools can't hold in-person classes is that they can't accommodate things like social distancing and other measures for safely preventing the spread of COVID-19. How are these learning pods different?
So the learning pods here, because we have large rehearsal rooms internal to the building that aren't being used because we're actually not able to produce large events for audiences at this point, means that we have very spacious rooms that allow us to socially distance these individual desks and tables. So the students each have their own 5-foot desk, their own individual chair. They're able to eat the provided lunch that's part of this program right in the individual classroom. But then we're able to tie in all of the STEAM programming that we've created here at the facility, from studio classes to light and sound workshops to Lego Mindstormers, into their individual daily curriculum. And as the schools locally have said, hey, they have about 2 to 3 hours of fixed work on their virtual learning day. That allows us to really complete the day and round it out for those students to ensure that they still have some social interaction and aren't just trapped at home.
Yeah, one of the critiques we've seen of pandemic pods, learning pods, is that it is an option for kids and families who are privileged and not for others. How are you trying to make sure that lots of different kids have the opportunity here?
That's a really great question. It's the reality that we face in this world. And so 1/3 of all of our spaces, so 20 in each of the classes, is a scholarship opportunity meant to really serve low to moderate income individuals to ensure that there is no boundary that prevents students from enrolling in this program and that cost is not the prohibiting factor. We've partnered with local nonprofits that would be most ingratiated to feed us students into those programs, or parents that have reached out directly, or mentors to these students that exist in the community have reached out. And we currently have spaces still left in those scholarship programs, in both programs, as well as open enrollment in the others. We have the addition to fill additional classrooms at this point.
And what kind of response are you getting from families so far?
Exceptionally positive response here locally, as the Eau Claire School District saw 1,000 families sort of move to online component or virtual learning, moving out of the hybrid model over the last week. They pushed back the virtual learning for 1 week. And in our survey of everyone enrolled asked us to push back our start. So rather than starting this morning, we'll be starting next Monday. Next Tuesday on September 8th will be the official start of the program. But we've seen feedback from parents saying that this was sort of the answer to their prayers, what they were looking for as they've been trying to figure out how were they going to keep their child at home for 3 days a week.
Yeah. I mean, what do you hope to accomplish with this?
I hope first and foremost that students are able to engage with one another, continue to grow socially, that they don't fall behind educationally. And if this building can be of service to the greater community, that we actually ingratiate and that more people become accustomed to all the things that the arts can offer and what the true value of the creative economy is to the greater region. But ultimately, we're here to serve the public and to assist families in the entire economy and rebounding at this point.
Jason, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for your time.
Jason John Anderson is the executive director at Pablo Center at the Confluence in Eau Claire. We talked with him about the center's new learning pods. They're providing students in the Chippewa Valley a socially distanced place to do virtual schoolwork during the day. They're also trying to take some of the pressure off parents who are juggling parenthood and their jobs. Coming up, the number of people with a will or other estate planning document has been on the decline over the past few years. We are talking about why it's good to have that taken care of, and we're answering your questions about wills and probate and other estate planning issues. So give us a call at 800-642-1234. Also, we've made some changes to keep you informed and connected here in Wisconsin and around the world. You'll find both 1A and On Point at new times, plus a few new shows and other changes. Take a listen. Let us know what you think. Find complete details on our website at WPR.org/fall2020. I'm Keely Boldina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're talking about holding elected officials accountable, especially in these last months ahead of an election. Tune into the Ideas Network from 6 until 9 tomorrow morning for that conversation and more. Now, do you have a will or some other kind of estate planning document? According to Caring.com, fewer of us have been taking care of that over the past few years. In a survey of 2,400 Americans, the number of adults with a will or another type of estate planning document decreased by 24% since 2017. And the study also shows that more people lack the knowledge and the resources to get a will. We're going to try to change that on this final day of National Make-A-Will Month. We'll also get into other matters of estate planning. Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is an attorney in Madison who focuses on estate planning and probate. She's the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy, and she blogs at GustafsonLegal.com. Melinda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Keely. It's always a pleasure to be here.
What do you hear when we talk about those numbers that it seems fewer people are getting their estate planning in order?
I'm actually surprised by that study because over the 15 years of my practice, I've always seen the statistics hover around that 30 to 35% mark of people who've actually completed an estate plan. And I'd be curious to see a follow-up study because in the past 6 months, estate planning has been a priority for many people across the nation.
A third of us have planned for what happens when we die, when it's inevitable, and the other two thirds just haven't made it happen?
I think that's a good summary.
So you mentioned, especially in these past few months, the pandemic has changed life in so many ways. How is it affecting the way we approach these end-of-life decisions?
I think it's putting a sense of urgency on things that many people had on their to-do list but never quite crossed off. At the beginning of the COVID outbreak here in Wisconsin, I noticed a large spike in the number of physicians contacting my office to explore estate planning. And now, as summer comes to an end and fall approaches, I've had an increase among educators that have this on their mind, and they're reaching out to find out about estate planning. So I do think, even prior to the pandemic, there's always some sort of nudge that gets people over that hump to make a call or to send an email. Many times in the past, it was a very bad diagnosis, sometimes a stage four cancer patient. People who are going to travel internationally were often motivated to do this. And then those that would be welcoming a child into their family felt compelled to do an estate plan. So I do think that, you know, COVID is just a different type of motivation for people to complete this.
Is it a different type of motivation for everybody? Or, I mean, you mentioned teachers. We also saw USA Today had a story about how teachers are drafting their will before they go back to school here. Is it affecting, is it motivating different people or in different professions?
You know, I think it's motivating most Americans, but I have seen, you know, my teachers as clients in the past would normally be people who would come in at the beginning of a summer to try to complete this process over the summer break. But now I'm seeing that uptick here during the fall or upcoming fall, when I know they're busy with their lesson plans, as that article talks about, but they're also adding this difficult task, or somewhat difficult task, of putting their thoughts and wishes into a legal format.
We are talking with Melissa Gustafson-Gervasi, who wrote a book on leaving a legacy. She's an estate planning attorney, and we're talking about how you can plan for the future. The lines are open now at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Again, the number 800-642-1234 with your question as we talk about drafting a will, getting our final affairs in order. Melinda, we'll go into more detail, but generally speaking, what happens if we don't have estate planning documents ready to go?
Sure. Well, I think the word estate planning covers a large array of types of documents. To me, estate planning is planning for illness, planning for death, and planning for taxes. We'll focus just on the planning for death. If you pass away and you are a Wisconsin resident and you do not have a will in place, then you actually do have one. It's a default that is in the state statute. So essentially, you're letting the legislature determine where your probate assets would go. And I do want to emphasize it's your probate assets. Those are assets that don't have a co-owner or don't have a named beneficiary. Those assets would be distributed by the statutes through the court process known as probate. People also own non-probate property, and those are assets that do have something like a co-owner or a beneficiary form that's complete, some sort of label associated with the asset that says where that investment or asset would go upon their death. Those assets are not transferred through the probate process and are not controlled by a will. So if you don't have one, you're letting the state make a decision on it. And in terms of beneficiary forms, take your life insurance and you don't have that complete, then you're probably going to leave it up to the insurance company to make a decision. And it's usually embedded within their contract that you had when you set up that financial instrument. So you're losing control.
Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is talking with us now, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And Cyril in Madison has a question. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can I help?
I had a will made out several years ago. It was something I did through an online service, and I filled out the form online, and then they sent me a printed copy, which is my will. I'm wondering if I should have a lawyer review that to see if it's up to date and appropriate, or if I should have a new will made out, especially since so many years have gone by.
How many years has it been?
10 or more.
10 or more. Well, I think you should first start with having an expert review the document. You'll want to make sure that it was signed and dated and witnessed properly, because even if it's perfectly written but not dated properly, you run the risk of it not being a valid will. The other reason that you may want to have an expert, a lawyer, review it is sometimes I'll see clients who have done the same thing. They've taken control and done some paperwork on their own, but they make some assumptions. For example, that their spouse would just automatically be able to act, and then they name someone else. They've essentially written that person out. So there can be some tricky language depending on family structure and your wishes. I always think it's good to have an expert look over these things, because it's vitally important, I think, to take control. And if it looks good, you probably don't need to update one. I generally aim, when I'm drafting a will for clients, for that to last them a few decades, assuming that there's not a huge change of events in their life.
Thanks so much for that question, Cyril. And Melinda, Susan writes, my parents had a trust and I still had to go through probate. Susan says, be sure you have a primary and at least one secondary beneficiary on everything. What do you think of that suggestion to make sure that there are enough layers of people to carry out your wishes?
Well, there's a couple of points embedded in that question. The first, I always think it's you must have a primary and a contingent. I know I'm sort of the depressing person, because people will tell me who they want to act or where something should go. And then in that conversation, I kill that person off. And then I say, then who would it go to? And pre-pandemic, I used to keep chocolates in my office to perk people up when I asked those questions. So yes, I would agree with Susan, I think you said, that primary and a contingent is a goal to aim for. The other comment that she said about her parents having a trust, but they still had to go through probate, is a problem that we do see in this area of law. That probably meant that the parents had a trust document, but the trust had not been funded, meaning that the assets hadn't actually been put into the trust. If a trust is funded properly, the trust document, the trust agreement, is essentially a label and says where those assets will go upon death, thus keeping it outside of probate. If they had a trust and they had to go to probate, either all of the assets weren't in the trust, or perhaps they acquired a new asset and didn't put it into the trust. So if you're going to do a trust, I think it's essential in that area to seek out the guidance of an expert, specifically an estate planning and probate attorney. There are sometimes organizations that will try to talk to you about, 102 ways to avoid probate and come down for a free dinner at a new restaurant. More times than often, those might not be actual lawyers that are doing things, and thus they wouldn't have the capacity to retitle your home, for example, into the name of the trust. So it's proceed with some caution in that area.
We're talking with Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi about estate planning, about figuring out your will or a trust and making sure that your final wishes can be carried out after you die. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Larry in La Crosse is on the line. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Can you hear me now?
We can. What's on your mind?
Well, I hear estate planners and lawyers talk about how if you die without a will, it's the state legislature that determines how your probate is handled. But nobody ever says what that is.
All right, Larry, thanks for the question. What is probate?
Larry, was your question what is probate or what is the legislative plan?
What is the legislator's plan for your probate?
Sure. That's a great question. It's going to follow your statutory heirs. So it's going to go for first, do you have a spouse? If so, it goes to the spouse. If no spouse, it will then go down the family tree looking for children or grandchildren, etc. If there's no one going down, then it's going to go up. It'll look to your parents. If no parents, to your siblings. And it will go out, I think it's to like your third cousin twice removed or something to that extent. It's a quite extensive distribution. And I may have a outline of that on my website. I'm not sure. We just updated if that made it on or not. But there is a nice pictorial that I could share with you if you ever wanted to reach out through the blog or through my website.
All right. Thanks so much for that question, Larry. And we are talking about wills, probate, and other estate planning matters with Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She's an attorney who focuses on estate planning and probate. And you can join us. Do you have a will? What was it like putting it together? Email ideas at WPR.org to join the conversation. We continue this discussion in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's National Make a Will Month, at least for another few hours. We're talking about what a will does and doesn't do, who needs one, what happens if you die without a will. Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is an attorney in Madison who works on estate planning and probate, and we're taking your calls here on the Ideas Network. We've got Kelsey in Madison who wants to join the conversation. Hey, Kelsey.
Hi. Thank you so much for talking about this topic. I work professionally with dementia, helping my residents with their daily activities of living and helping their families navigate that transition. And when we talk about end-of-life planning, a lot of the times we talk about when we're, physically passed away. But many of us will encounter memory loss conditions if we live over 85. And so I just want to encourage everyone to make those plans, before you're approaching the end of life, because even the closest families can go through a lot of conflict and heartbreak if it's not clear what their loved one's wishes were, especially related to an activated power of attorney.
Kelsey, thank you so much for mentioning the healthcare power of attorney, durable power of attorney, even living wills here. Melinda.
Yes, I couldn't agree with Kelsey more. One thing from the will perspective, you don't want to be sick in the hospital and facing the reality of a upcoming death and making these decisions. It's just heart-wrenching for all involved. You also run the risk of losing capacity. You may not have the capacity to take care of things. And also during this current pandemic, there were points in time when a lawyer was not allowed access to a client that was in the hospital or in a hospice center. So this is not the time to wait for that. More importantly is the idea that Kelsey brought up too, is many things, we don't always die in a car accident swiftly. There can be a long debilitating illness. And so if you are alive, but too sick to make your own decisions, whether they be financial or in the health area, you can take control and create powers of attorney. Wisconsin has one for finance and the other for healthcare. And they allow you to say who's in charge of making those decisions for you, and then to have a backup or even sometimes a third person on there. And it's a crucial role, because if you don't have that in place, if you haven't taken the time to complete that paperwork and say who should act, someone from your family and friend network will need to likely go to court to file for guardianship. And that is just a financial expense, an emotional expense during a time when a loved one is very, very ill. And so if you can, take control now and put those wishes on paper and then go out and have a good time.
Thanks so much for that perspective, that idea, Kelsey. Now we've got Marcus in Milwaukee who has a question. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. So I do remodeling and construction. I cut my hand on the 25th and I almost bled out. So this is a very poignant topic for me. I do artwork just for personal relaxation, enjoyment, whatever. And I have over 350 pieces, which I would like to pass down to my children. Problem is I'm divorced. So what would I need to do in a situation with something like that?
Oh, Marcus, I'm glad you're okay. But thank you for bringing up that experience. Melinda.
Marcus, that's a great question. And I think what you're asking is, how can you have control over your artwork or any other assets that if you were to pass when your children were perhaps too young to take possession of them? Is that correct?
Correct.
Well, the answer is, if we want to have control after our death, a trust is the vehicle that we can do that with. And often you'll hear about the living revocable trust. Those are a complex and very pricey instrument to do that. But we also have something here in Wisconsin that's called a testamentary trust. So the others are living revocable trusts and are a lot more difficult to set up. A testamentary trust is a few paragraphs, somewhere between maybe an 8 to 10 paragraphs that are embedded in your will. And they say that the trust would come into existence only upon your death. So it's only upon the worst case scenario. And then you can appoint a person known as the trustee to manage the assets that are in the trust, and your will would be able to leave that artwork collection to the trust so that you know that a person who is going to follow your wishes is in charge of that. And you can set an age at which the children will be able to take possession of the artwork, or whether it was a life insurance policy or anything else that was in the trust. And I find those to be quite useful for many of my clients. They're much simpler to create. They're far more affordable to create. And the trust only comes into existence in that worst case scenario. And hopefully you'll reach a point where your children are old enough and you don't need it anymore, and you can just revert back to a basic will.
All right. We're talking with Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi, who's an attorney in Madison who focuses on estate planning and probate. And we're figuring out how to get things in line to make sure that what we want to have happen when we die actually happens. And we've got Mark from Neenah who wants to talk with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. I have a question. You brought up retitling assets. And
yes.
Our estate attorney is from, and you'd know the name, but I won't say it, a very large law firm in Appleton, Green Bay area. And I asked him like twice or three times because my parents had a trust and they retitled their house and they retitled whatever. And he told us we didn't have to do that in Wisconsin because there's a part of the law that allows everything to just flow into the trust without having to retitle it.
All right. Mark, thanks so much. Melinda, what do you know about this area?
Mark, that is something I would want to look into more specifically. I know there are different vehicles from which you can transfer things into a trust that avoid the probate, or sometimes it's through a pour over will. Without knowing more facts about the situation and what type of trust your attorney set up, there's many different types. I wouldn't be able to say I wouldn't be able to comment thoroughly on what they had set up. I do know there are different instruments out there. Standard practice, things that I do in my office, would be to retitle those assets into the trust, because then I know with certainty they're in there, but I'm not going to second guess the work of another attorney without knowing more.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Melinda. What I hear Mark saying, too, is that he is kind of wondering, you know, is this attorney on the right track for what I'm looking for? If you find yourself in that position, what should you do as the client?
Well, first know that you have a right to your client file. And if you'd like to pull your client file from that office, you can go and seek other counsel. Proper format would be to tell the lawyer, thank you for the work you did, but I would like my client file. And then you can make an appointment with another estate planning attorney to review that situation. And the reason you do that is if you already have an attorney, I, as a new attorney, would be prohibited from speaking to you about that because there's already an attorney assigned to the case. So that would be one step. And I do see people who come into my office and for whatever reason, they felt that their needs or their wishes maybe weren't heard correctly, or they just, attorneys have different styles of communicating. And, you know, if you're not comfortable with it, I would urge you to first maybe revisit with that attorney and give her or him a chance to explain again to you in very basic terms what they're using. You should have a very clear sense of what the law is and how the instrument works. And if you don't get that, then I would encourage you to talk around. If you have a CPA or a financial planner you work with, you could always ask them for a name of a referral for someone who's similar to how they run their practice. So if you like your CPA, who does your CPA recommend?
Melinda, Liz commented on our Facebook page, it costs so much money to hire a lawyer to do it. I don't have any extra to hire a lawyer. What do you do when a will is a top priority for you and you just don't know how to handle the cost?
Sure. Well, I think one is educate yourself on how much it costs. Many of my clients can be surprised at the cost of a simple basic will. It's a flat fee that they can work into a budget. There's all variety out there. If you are truly of limited means, you could contact one of the law schools here in the state to see if they have a clinic that could assist you at no cost. You'd be working with a law student under the supervision of an attorney. That's one option. And I know, I haven't looked at it recently, but that the state law library sold for $10 a basic fill-in-the-blank will for Wisconsin. It may not work in everyone's situation, but I do think that there are probably more options out there than you might realize. And then attorneys don't always have to cost as much as maybe TV shows and movies make us appear to be.
So maybe worth a phone call to explain the situation, figure out how extensive your estate plan is going to be, and then you can make better decisions.
Correct. And I'll add that the more control that you're going to want to have, especially what we call dead hand control, the more complicated it is, the higher the cost will be. So if you can pick a main priority about having yourself organized or making sure, like Marcus had said about controlling his artwork, that was a control issue. Some people want a simplicity issue. If you have one priority, I think the whole process will be easier and probably more affordable.
All right. Melinda, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is an attorney in Madison who focuses on estate planning and probate. She's the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. You've been listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Join us again from 6 to 9 a.m. for the morning show. That is 6 to 9 a.m. right here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.